Michael Gargiulo was once again a free man, able to escape charges in Cook County, Illinois, due to issues with the DNA evidence in Tricia Picaccio's murder. In 2005, Gargiulo met a woman named Grace Quack, and the two began a relationship. In September of 2005, Gargiulo and Quack, who was pregnant with Gargiulo's second child, had moved into a second-floor apartment in the 4600 block of Arden Way in El Monte. 2 months later, on November 23, 2005, a woman named Maria Bruno moved in across the apartment complex. A 32-year-old aspiring model, she was originally from El Salvador and had four children. She had just separated from her husband, Irving, a few weeks prior to moving in. Despite only living in the apartment for 10 days, Bruno had already complained to friends about a weird guy who had been watching her. Robert Rasmussen, one of Bruno's neighbors, remembers seeing an unknown man wearing a hoodie and a baseball hat who was jiggling Bruno's doorknob and peering through her window. On another occasion, he saw the same man following her as she carried groceries. Rasmussen said Bruno went into the apartment and the man followed her in, but the minute he went inside, he backed out and the door was shut in his face. Then on the night of November 30th, 2005, Maria went out with her estranged husband, Irving. After a night of drinking, Maria was too intoxicated to drive home, so Irving took her back to her apartment. The two had sex, then Irving got dressed and left around 3 a.m. He returned the following morning to drive Maria to work, but when Maria didn't answer the door, he noticed her kitchen window screen was missing. Irving crawled through the window and found Maria's body laying in a pool of blood. He called 911 in a chilling call as he describes the brutality of the scene.
Did you see her?
Yes, I'm looking at her right now. She's dead.
Okay. Thank you, Abby.
Bring in Detective Mark Lilienfeld. He's with the LA County Sheriff's Department and was one of the first on the scene. Mark, what do you remember about the crime scene?
You know, I have a relatively, even though it's been a long time, over a decade and a half, I have a pretty clear memory of it. You know, it was a big apartment complex, and there were three identical two-story rectangular-shaped apartment buildings that made up this complex. And it was, they were all lined up. They were on the east side of a north-south street. And each of the buildings kind of was an entity of their own. And they were connected by a common driveway and stuff. And each building had about 80 apartment units in each of them. So there were, you know, 200-plus apartments, one-bedroom, two-bedroom apartments in the buildings. And Maria's building where the murder occurred was actually the southernmost apartment in the line of them. And it had a long driveway going up the side of the building to the rear parking area. And it was pretty secure. And the city where this occurred, the city of El Monte, is a kind of a working class, mostly Hispanic community. It's about 20 miles east of downtown Los Angeles. It is an incorporated city unto itself. It has its own city government, including its police department and things along those lines. And the reason that I was called out there, I was a Los Angeles County Sheriff, and the El Monte Police Department simply is under-resourced and underfunded to investigate murders that occur within their jurisdiction. So they quite often ask for assistance from the county sheriff. So I remember specifically that the building where this occurred was a two-story rectangular building, had a swimming pool in the center of it. It was like a million other apartment buildings in Southern California. They're like cookie cutters. They're all the same. And the crime scene itself, where the victim lived, was a ground floor apartment. It was on the north side of the building. It was very close to the pool. And it was a typical one bedroom, one bath, you know, kind of a studio, small, you know, bachelorette type apartment. It couldn't have been, you know, maybe 400 square feet, 500 square feet. And one of the things that I remember very clearly and that drew my attention right away when I got there was just outside of the apartment door by about 10 feet on the, you know, the patio or the pavement of the courtyard was a blue cotton medical like booty, like a shoe protector. And it was pretty obvious it was, you know, going to be a piece of evidence. And the El Monte police officers that got there on scene and had the fire department roll and pronounce the victim dead, they knew right away this is going to be a piece of evidence. So they had, you know, kind of like chalked it off and they had preserved it so it wouldn't be disturbed. And like I said, I remember it pretty vividly. I remember the layout of the apartment because I spent many, many hours there that day and subsequent days too. And when you open the front door, you were immediately in like a very small kind of an entryway. And then you were really standing in the living room. And to your left of the front door was a bar. And by a bar, I don't mean a drinking bar, you know, that kind of bar, but just a countertop. And that divided the kitchen from the living room. And on the other side of this countertop was the kitchen. And it was a small kind of a galley type kitchen. You know, it had an oven and, you know, a microwave and the typical kitchen sink. And at the end of the kitchen was a window that looked out onto the courtyard. So the window was just adjacent to the front door. And then just beyond the kitchen was kind of a very small doorway. And it led to, there was a bathroom on the left, you know, typical with a tub and a shower and a toilet and a sink. And a short hallway with kind of like a linen closet in the hallway. And then just beyond that, at the end of that hallway opposite the bathroom was a doorway that led to the single bedroom in the apartment. And it was, you know, your typical, you know, like a 10 foot by 12 foot bedroom. It was the only bedroom in the apartment. It had a king size bed, I believe, and a dresser. And the victim was lying in the bed in a pool of blood. There were sheets and blankets and covers on the bed, if I recall, and pillows. And there was quite a bit of clothing strewn about. And it turned out, ultimately, we determined the victim had just moved into this apartment like 10 days earlier. And so there were still a couple of boxes containing shoes and clothing and purses and the typical stuff, you know, that a young woman would have when she's moving from one place to another. So a lot of stuff was packed. A lot of stuff was unpacked. And there was, you know, quite a bit of, you know, blouses and pants and shorts and jeans and things like that that were hung up in the closet. And then a lot of stuff was just piled kind of in piles, both on the floor and on the dresser. There was nightstands on either side of the bed, and I recall all the furniture was brand new. The apartment smelled of new paint. The carpeting was fresh, freshly cleaned, and it was really a pretty pristine apartment. It was almost like a model apartment. You know, it was like something you would show prospective tenants to view. To you know, hey, you know, you can live in this fabulous lifestyle kind of deal. And it was a secure building. The only way to enter the interior of the building was either through a passcode punched into a keypad, or if you had like a magnetic key card. Those are the only two ways to get into that building. It was a relatively secure building. If you wanted to drive to the back driveway parking area that was unsecured, same thing. You had to have either a, you know, kind of a pass key magnetic credit card thing that would open a vehicle gate and allow you to drive through, or you had to have a like a four-digit code to punch into a keypad that would allow the gate to open. It was actually one of the attractions for the building that the victim, Maria Bruno, had. That's one of the reasons she picked that building, is because she was just recently separated from her husband. She was looking for a secure place, and that building caught her eye as being, especially for that part of town and that city in particular, extraordinarily secure.
Did you notice anything about the victim's body that stood out?
I did. Both my partner and I, and of course the crime lab people, and even the officers that were there from El Monte Police Department. I mean, it was a pretty, I had already been a homicide cop for a long time. I had been to hundreds of homicide scenes, hundreds of other death scenes and all that. So I was a pretty older, mature, experienced guy. I'd kind of been around. You know, if you're a murder cop in L.A., it's kind of like being a murder cop on steroids. You know, it ain't Waco, Texas, or Madison, Illinois. It's busy, to say the least. So, I was told, you know, what to expect, and when I walked in, I was, you know, it was an accurate depiction. Miss Bruno was lying on the bed. She was lying on her side. She was nude. She was somewhat wrapped up a little bit in the bedding, in the cover and the sheet or the blanket. And it like on first appearance, it appeared to me as if the body had been posed, which it turns out that it was. And there was a lot of blood all over the bedding, all over her. And it almost looked like at first as if she had been decapitated. She had not. But she had suffered really severe lacerations to her neck and chest area. Both breasts had been removed. One breast was actually placed in her mouth, and one was actually placed on the pillow next to her head. And that right away was, you know, it's like crap you see in a movie. It's just not real life. I have been to other murders, you know, that were gory and bloody and all that stuff, but I'd never really been to one quite like that. And certainly, you know, where the body was posed and where there was, you know, sexual mutilation. So it was pretty remarkable, you know, pretty unusual and stuff, to say the least. So there wasn't a lot of mystery as to the cause of death. Was obviously from a sharp force object like a knife. And that was, in fact, the cause of death. Wasn't too hard to figure that out. And there wasn't like a lot of blood like sprayed on the walls or on the furniture. There was some blood on the nightstand, if I recall, next to her, next to the bed. A great deal of blood on the bed, of course, and the bedding. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, again, you know, even cops aren't immune from what we think we're going to see on TV or in the movies. So that was my first impression of it. There was no weapon in the immediate bedroom or in the immediate area. When I had entered the apartment, in the kitchen, which, like the rest of the apartment, was very clean, lying on the floor of the kitchen, and it had been pointed out to me previously by the uniformed patrol cops, but lying on the floor of the kitchen was a package. It was a knife package, like you would buy at, you know, Bed Bath & Beyond, and it had four spots on it, on the cellophane wrapping or the plastic wrapping for different size knives, like a paring knife and a cutlery knife and a, you know, a steak knife and kind of like a, you know, a big butcher kind of knife. And one of those four knives was missing. The other three were still in the package from the manufacturer. the handles were kind of sticking out from the plastic that was protecting the blade part of it. But the missing knife was a long, you know, there was an outline manufactured on the package of the size of the knife, and it looked like a big knife. You know, it looked like a big, almost like a filleting knife, like a single-edged knife with a wooden handle, if I recall correctly. And it must have had like a 6 or 7 inch blade. And so, again, you know, that mystery wasn't, I'm not the brightest tool in the shed here. If I can figure that stuff out, you know, it's not a lot of mystery to it, that putting two and two together from the scene in the bedroom and the injuries on the victim and then the knife packaging being in the kitchen, anybody can draw that conclusion that most likely your weapon is from the home there. It's from that knife package.
Detective, did you have any indication or suspect or possible motives?
You know, we relatively quickly, you know, we had to focus because of the amount of violence and the fact that it was the estranged husband who found her. We certainly had to question him. And by questioning him, I don't mean sit down and ask questions, you know, across a table. I mean, you know, he kind of, you know, if you're looking for people that are potential suspects, an estranged husband who's going through a divorce would be, you know, right at the top of the list. And again, I'd love to do the Sherlock Holmes thing, but Ray Charles and Helen Keller both would tell you that it's pretty simple, pretty basic stuff. So we met him after we did the crime scene investigation. He actually waited for us for hours in the lobby of the police department. He wasn't under arrest. He was free to go. And he simply was, you know, he made arrangements to care for his four children. And he didn't move a muscle out of the lobby. And he waited for us for like 7 or 8, 9 hours in the lobby of this apartment. We didn't get to him until late in the afternoon. And this murder, you know, occurred like in the early morning hours, and we discovered it, I think, around 7 or 8 in the morning. And then by the time we processed the crime scene, it was 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon. And when we, meaning my partner and I, got back to the El Monte Police Department, the husband, Irving, was waiting for us in the lobby. So we wound up interviewing him at great length. I mean, we talked to him for, I think we talked to him for 4 or 5 hours. And he was totally cooperative, and I did not get like a bad feel about the guy, like, gee, this guy's lying. He wasn't contradictory. He just didn't display any of the indicators of being responsible for this at all. He was obviously upset. He was very frank with us about the details of their marriage, why they were separated, why Maria had just recently moved into this building, why that apartment. You know, so it wasn't that he was uncooperative at all, quite the opposite. So we ultimately, after kind of getting that preliminary elimination of him, thinking potentially he's really not our guy, at least he's not jumping out, you know, biting us in the nose that he's our guy. From there, you know, just kind of spitballing, gee, who would do such a horrible thing? You know, what's the motive? Is it a robbery? Did Maria owe money? Was she a third woman in a, you know, a triangular love triangle? I mean, it, you know, she's not a dope fiend. You can eliminate a lot of simple things. And the fact that she was nude, the fact that she was sexually mutilated, the fact that her body was posed, the fact she was a very attractive woman living alone. And it did not appear the apartment was ransacked. It didn't appear that any property was taken. So you draw conclusions by eliminating other avenues. So by excluding other potential motivations, you draw a conclusion. Cops do it all the time. Scientists do it. People do it all the time. They draw conclusions by eliminating other things. So we were able to do that relatively quickly. And you know, this was, it had all the earmarks of being, gee, this is potentially sexually motivated. This woman's sexually mutilated. And she's nude. She's very attractive. She lives alone. And the body is posed, and both breasts are cut off. Not to you know, beat that into the ground for the salaciousness of it, but it's a clue. I mean, it's an indicator of what's motivating behind this murder. You know, it wasn't her. You know, her $10,000 Rolex wasn't missing. Her, you know, money wasn't missing. Nothing was missing, hardly at all, with the exception of the murder weapon. ultimately, we determined that actually her keys were missing, and I believe that was the only thing that was that we never recovered from that apartment or from the murder scene was her keys. And that in itself didn't, you know, that could be a very, there were a number of what could be innocent explanations behind that, as well as potentially that the suspect who did the murder took her keys when he left. So, and to this day, that's never been answered, actually. I'm going to go with the suspect actually took the keys and that they weren't misplaced or lost, but that remains a possibility.
Have you ever seen a blue medical booty at a crime scene before?
I have seen at crime scenes in the past efforts made by suspects to not leave forensic evidence, like a burglar that wears gloves, or you know somebody that enters a building or a home to do some kind of a crime, and they'll take prophylactic measures of one type or another to avoid leaving, you know, evidence, whether it be fingerprints or DNA. Or something like that. Sexual predators, those that are, you know, really kind of premeditated and have a game plan. Quite often, they will make their victims take a shower, or they'll actually wear a condom or do something to avoid, you know, leaving evidence at a crime scene. So seeing the blue booty there was not. It just wasn't a huge leap that, gee, this is unusual. Maybe a brain surgeon, you know, lives in this apartment building and they dropped their booty on the way from surgery. It's like, you know, there's not a lot of mystery to that. You can draw that assumption, you know, and be somewhat suspicious and raise an eyebrow that most likely the suspect, and it turned out to be correct, wore this booty, this prophylactic device, to avoid leaving a shoe prints or boot prints or footprints. And ultimately, in the investigation, that was borne out, that was a fact.
What were the next steps of the investigation?
We were hoping to get a fingerprint. We were hoping to get DNA. And we really didn't get either very quickly at all. It took months and months to develop DNA off of the blue booty. And even then, we did not have a match for that DNA right away. So it was, you know, 1955. It was your old fashioned murder. We did not have video. There were, in fact, a couple of security video cameras, but they were not working, and they were not the type that recorded images. They were there like closed circuit so they could watch images, and even some of those didn't work properly. So, you know, what cops have been doing for 100 plus years, we started knocking on doors. And again, you know, earlier I described this is three apartment buildings that are right next to each other. They're all part of the same, you know, complex, and there are 80 apartments in each complex. So we're talking 230, 240 individual apartments. So my partner and I, you know, got our tape recorders charged up, and we worked with some other cops and started knocking on doors and knocked on doors and knocked on doors and knocked on doors. And it took us, you know, quite a few days to canvas the entire building. Of course, some people work 4 to midnight, some people work midnight to 8, so not everybody's home. You wind up leaving business cards, you wind up getting phone calls later. Like every other homicide cop in America, in the beginning, you wind up working very, very long, hard hours, and that's what we did. We wound up eventually knocking on every one of those apartment doors and contacting the bulk of those, and I want to say it's around 230, 240 residents. And we wound up talking to almost everybody. Did you see anything? Did you hear anything? Do you know anything? Has there been any kind of suspicious activity going on? So on and so forth. So that's a big chunk of that investigation. From there, we kind of drew a circle outside of the apartment building and started knocking on doors on people that lived in houses across the street and people that lived down the block. And, you know, has there been anything unusual, you know, any suspicious people? And, you know, again, this is Los Angeles, you know, it's the second largest city in the nation. You know, it's got 10 million people in Los Angeles County. It's a big damn place. So, you know, there's a lot going on all the time. It's truly, you know, a vibrant place, even though El Monte is a suburb of Los Angeles and a city unto itself. It's a big community. You know, I don't recall exactly, but I believe El Monte itself must have, maybe 50 or 100,000 people population that live there. It's a major hub in many ways of manufacturing and you know commerce, and it's a bedroom community also. but it's also got, you know, quite a bit of other things going for it. So it's a big city. So, you know, we're doing the best we can under the circumstances to try to narrow down, you know, talking to people. That's what cops do, is communicate and try to see if anybody heard anything or saw anything. Or, you know, it turned out one of the better leads we got relatively quickly was from a woman that lived in a building unrelated to the apartment complex where the murder happened, but she lived a couple of buildings south. And she was awakened by a burglar. And when he startled her sleeping on the couch, he ran away. So we thought, gee, that's pretty good. You know, and the guy got into her apartment through a window. I mean, that could be our guy. You know, let's work that burglary. And so we started working that pretty hard, putting a lot of effort into that. We didn't get any fingerprints, but in talking to other witnesses, knocking on doors, and so on and so forth, we developed enough evidence to focus on one guy. We did a search warrant at this one guy's home. He lived in the neighborhood, and he was good for the burglary, and he alibied out for our murder, and we were able to eliminate him as being the suspect in our murder. We ultimately charged him with the burglary of this unrelated woman's place, but, you know, that's essentially, you know, it's what cops do. I mean, you go where the clue, wherever the evidence takes you, and that's where that particular evidence took us. So it wasn't, you know, again, I want to be Sherlock Holmes here and, you know, tell you what a great job we did, but it was kind of just going through the numbers, you know, start at A and go to Z, and it's not, it's pretty routine in that respect. The work that we meaning detectives or homicide detectives, what we do is kind of, you know, not all that different than piloting an airplane, and you go down a checklist. You don't truly have a checklist like a pilot would, but you know, there are certain things you do, and the physical evidence at the crime scene is one of the first things. And the next thing is to look for, you know, even back then in 2005, to look for video evidence or evidence of suspicious activity. And you get that by knocking on doors and talking to people. So that's what we did. That was a big part of the investigation, was meeting people, talking to people. We looked at old police reports for activity or calls to service there. And it's a big building, 240 residents. So there are, you know, people call the cops. Hey, there's a car blocking my parking space. Hey, there's a suspicious guy in the laundry room. Hey, my work van got broken into, my tools got stolen. So, you know, crime doesn't stop necessarily, you know, where a major crime occurs. I've got to not laugh about it. It's actually tragic, but like when 9/11 happened and the Twin Towers went down, I mean, there were thousands of automobile accidents that took, you know, the lives of thousands of Americans that day, and thousands of people got arrested for drunk driving. And sadly, hundreds of people got murdered all across America unrelated to 9/11. I mean, you know, life keeps going on despite tragedy, and this tragedy was no different. You know, people kept, you know, looting and stealing and robbing and pillaging and doing the bad crap that people do. And you know, it happened after this murder, it happened before this murder. And, you know, our job is to kind of identify that and see if there's a correlation. And so that kind of took us in that direction. That's kind of where we went.
What can you tell us about Maria Bruno?
She was about 32 years old. She was an immigrant to this country, I believe from Central America, and I want to say from El Salvador. She came to this country, I believe, as a young teenager. She got married very young to a young man that she had fallen in love with and met and fallen in love with, hopefully in that order. And they'd been married about 10 years. And they had twins. The twins, I think, were like 4 years old. And then she had like a 5-year-old. And a 6-year-old. Her husband, Irving, was a middle-class, nice guy, bright guy, had a degree in psychology, I believe. They owned and operated a video rental store, which kind of dates this murder, I guess, because we don't have those kinds of stores anymore, like a Blockbuster, but, you know, a family-owned thing. And it was also a currency exchange where people could go there and transfer money by wire, you know, from this exchange to their loved ones or to anybody they wanted anywhere in the world. So that was how these people lived and supported themselves. They lived in a very nice home in a very nice residential area. Maria was somewhat I think both of them, the marriage had kind of run its course, and they had both kind of just decided mutually that the marriage was over and they were going to take a break and most likely get a divorce. So they were, it was very civil between them. It wasn't, you know, like a, you know, screaming Peyton Place kind of, I hate your guts, I never want to see you again type deal at all. And Maria actually moved out of the home, which is a little bit unusual. And together they found her a nice, clean, secure apartment to move into, and ultimately, which wasn't so secure. So that was her background. She really didn't have a lot of relatives here in this country. She had a cousin, I remember, that was a male cousin that was in the United States Navy in San Diego. And she had some other distant relatives, I believe an uncle. But she really didn't have anybody else here other than the immediate family. And so her husband, her husband's parents, you know, were those closest to her.
Detective, what did Maria's friends and neighbors tell you when you spoke to them?
You know, I mean, the more you know about the victim, the more you're going to potentially know about the suspect. So we did a background as much as we possibly could about Maria. And, you know, she seemed like a really nice woman. She was very, very pretty. She was kind of trying to break into modeling. She'd had some photos of her taken professionally and had kind of hit that circuit a little bit, but never found a whole lot of success in it. She worked when her and her husband decided to dissolve the marriage and separate. She got a job at a furniture store there in El Monte, and she worked in the credit department very briefly. She'd only been to work for a very short period of time before her death. And prior to that, she had worked with her husband at the video store. But she was, you know, like no enemies, and she didn't have, you know, this kind of crazy life where she was a high risk victim. She wasn't at all, you know, somebody that took chances. You know, just a mom with four little kids trying to do the best she could raising little kids in a hectic, you know, hectic life that we all live and everything. And so there wasn't anything that stuck out that she was a big risk taker. She, since her separation, had dated a little bit. She had gone out with a few different men. We wound up meeting them. A couple of them were, one of them at least that comes to mind was a young man that lived there in the apartment building. You know, and he was totally co-op, and we were able again to kind of eliminate him as being a suspect pretty easily through the timeline that we had developed. And then she had dated another guy a little bit more seriously, who was a restaurant manager in the city of Pasadena. And Pasadena is about 10 miles from El Monte. And so he was able to provide us with some background about Maria and what kind of girl she was and, you know, what they liked and, you know, did together. And they'd go out to eat and movies and the usual, you know, stuff that people do when you're getting to know each other and dating each other and stuff. He provided us a story that turned out to be very valuable later on. And basically, he said that when Maria had moved into the building, she had had a very brief confrontation with another occupant of the building. And the guy that had confronted her had actually followed her into her apartment when her hands were full. She was carrying a box from the parking lot through the courtyard and into her apartment. And when she turned around after setting the box down, this guy, this young man, was standing there, and he kind of startled her. And it pissed her off. And she kind of yelled at the guy and told him, you know, get the hell out of my apartment. And the guy did. And it kind of creeped her out. And ultimately, she learned that the guy actually lived in her building and that he lived across the way. And across the way are three words that she used in describing where this guy lived. So she told her friend, Brian, who is the manager of a restaurant that she had kind of started dating. She told him that story. So that was kind of, it creeped her out, and she told that story to Brian. And then a couple of days later, she went out with Brian again, and she told him, you know, that creepy guy I told you about across the way, he's not what I thought he was. He's okay. Like she wasn't in, she wasn't not in harm's way, but she wasn't as alert or have that stranger danger spidey sense thing going where this guy's a creep. He bothers me. I've got to be extra careful around him. That she kind of had let her guard down around him in some manner based on her statement to Brian, her buddy. So ultimately, we wound up actually finding an actual eyewitness, an older gentleman that lived in the building across the courtyard from Maria, who saw the confrontation that she had described to Brian, where the guy had followed her into her apartment. He was in there for probably less than 10 or 20 seconds before he backed out when she, you know, did the aggressive thing of, you know, who the hell are you and get out of my friggin' home. So that was, you know, something that, you know, quite often in murder investigations, the littlest things that don't seem to have a great importance turn out to be, you know, amongst the most important things.
Back to the evidence from the crime scene. Drops of blood from the medical booty would find Maria Bruno's DNA as well as another unidentified man. One thing was for sure. The DNA did not match her husband, Irving, and it also didn't match anyone in the database. So we have three women, Trisha Picaccio, Ashley Elrin, and now Maria Bruno, all brutally murdered with a knife, and all three living in close proximity to Michael Gargiulo. None of the murders had evidence of the woman being sexually assaulted, and no items or belongings were taken by the killer. Gargiulo, who was living right across from Maria, was never interviewed by the police. His girlfriend, Grace Quack, had moved out by that time. In 2006, Gargiulo started working for Gus the Plumber with a man named Gustavo Bone. He started a new relationship with a woman named Ana Luis Gonzalez. According to LA Weekly, the two met at a showroom for plumbing and bathroom remodeling. They would eventually get married, and in 2007, Gargiulo moved into Gonzalez's apartment with her mother in Santa Monica, California. In 2008, yet another woman who lived close to Gargiulo would be brutally attacked by a knife. But this time, the victim lived to tell her story. In our next episode, we'll hear that story, the big break police had been waiting for, and how it tied together the murders of Trisha Picaccio, Ashley Elrin, and Maria Bruno. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper.